Nobody warned Mary Whitmore that the carriage ride to her future would smell like horse and disappointment. She had imagined it differently. She had imagined it many times, in fact, with the particular thoroughness of a young woman who has spent 19 years reading novels and constructing, from their accumulated evidence, a fairly detailed portrait of what her life was supposed to look like. The carriage was supposed to be grander. The road was supposed to be lined with something. Trees, perhaps, or the kind of picturesque hedgerows that featured prominently in the descriptions she had catalogued. There was supposed to be, at minimum, a sense of occasion. What there was instead was mud. An impressive quantity of mud, of the specific Derbyshire variety that appeared to have ambitions beyond the road, and was making a creditable attempt on the carriage wheels. There was also her mother, seated across from her with the expression of a woman who has successfully concluded a negotiation and is already mentally spending the proceeds. "You are very quiet," her mother observed. "I am thinking," Mary said. "Think less and smile more," her mother said. "First impressions are everything." Mary looked out the window at the mud. She had, until approximately 6 weeks ago, believed that her first impression of a husband would be formed across a candle-lit drawing room in the context of a formal introduction arranged by mutual acquaintance with the appropriate quantity of social ceremony to cushion the significance of the occasion. She had not believed it would be formed in the receiving hall of a Derbyshire estate she had never visited, arranged by parents who had met the Duke of Ravenshire twice and considered that sufficient basis for a lifetime commitment. Her father had presented the arrangement with the brisk satisfaction of a man closing a business deal that had come together more neatly than expected. The Duke of Ravenshire was 32, solvent, and in possession of a title of considerable antiquity. He required a wife. The Whitmores required, in the frank accounting of their particular social situation, an elevation that Mary's modest fortune and considerable personal qualities had not yet managed to secure through the conventional mechanisms. The arrangement suited both parties. Mary had said, "Has anyone asked the Duke whether he finds the arrangement suitable?" Her father had looked at her with the mild bewilderment he reserved for questions that seemed to him to have obvious answers. "He proposed it," he said. "Has anyone asked me?" she said. The silence that followed this question was the silence of a family confronting a concept they had not previously considered necessary. Then her mother said, gently, but with the firmness of someone who has already concluded the relevant deliberation, "Mary, darling, it is an excellent match." And so here she was, in the mud, going to meet a duke. She allowed herself one private, unobserved moment of genuine feeling, a mixture of fear and something that was not quite excitement, but was adjacent to it, the feeling of standing at the edge of something large. And then she composed her expression into the pleasant, interested, appropriately modest look that she had been trained to produce for significant occasions, and waited for the carriage, A, to arrive. Part 1. First Impressions. Ravenshire Park was, she had to admit, exactly as grand as advertised. The approach alone, a long gravel drive flanked by mature elms that had been growing in their current positions for longer than her family had existed, communicated the particular message of old money that no amount of recent prosperity could replicate. The house itself was a Georgian masterpiece in pale stone, its proportions so correct that looking at it produced the specific satisfaction of something perfectly balanced, every window and column in its right place, the whole facade saying, "We have been here a long time and we intend to continue." Mary looked at it through the carriage window and thought, "Someone lives here who does not need anything from me, and that is either reassuring or terrifying, and I cannot yet determine which." The butler who met them at the door was a man of such extraordinary composure that he appeared to have been specifically designed for the purpose of making arriving guests feel that their arrival was both expected and slightly insufficient. He directed them to a drawing room with the practiced efficiency of a man who has managed the arrival of hundreds of guests and has formed settled opinions about most of them. The drawing room was beautiful. High ceilings, tall windows overlooking a formal garden that was doing its best despite the season, furniture that managed to be both comfortable and impeccable in the particular way of things that have been carefully chosen and then left alone for long enough to develop character. A fire burned in the carved marble fireplace. On the mantelpiece, a clock ticked with the measured authority of an object that has been keeping accurate time since before anyone currently present was born. Mary sat and looked at the room and tried to read it the way she read novels, for what it revealed about the people who inhabited it. The books were real and well used, she noted. The spines showed the particular wear of books that had been read rather than displayed. The painting above the fireplace was a landscape, not a portrait, which suggested either an unusual lack of family vanity or a preference for the natural world over its human inhabitants. The flowers on the table were fresh and well arranged, which meant someone in this household paid attention to flowers, which told her something, though she was not yet sure what. She was in the middle of this assessment when the door opened. Anthony Ashford, 5th Duke of Ravenshire, was not what she had expected. She had expected, the novels had led her to expect, someone with the particular quality of aristocratic beauty that featured in her mental catalogue, dark and brooding, or golden and commanding, with the kind of face that communicated at a glance that its owner was accustomed to being looked at and had made appropriate arrangements. What she got was a man of 32, who was unquestionably handsome, but whose handsomeness was of the practical, rather than the decorative variety. A lean, angular face, with grey eyes that were currently conducting a rapid assessment of the room's occupants with the focused attention of someone checking inventory, dark hair that appeared to have had a difficult morning, and an expression of controlled civility that was doing its best to conceal something she could not yet identify. He bowed. She curtsied. Her mother smiled with the expansive warmth of a woman who has successfully concluded a negotiation. Her father shook hands with the relief of a man who has delivered a complicated package to its correct destination. "Miss Whitmore," the Duke said. His voice was measured and clear, neither warm nor cold, the voice of a man who has learned to deploy courtesy as a professional tool. "Your Grace," she said. They looked at each other. She was attempting to read his expression and finding it. For the first time in her considerable experience of reading expressions, genuinely opaque. He was, she would understand this more fully later, doing precisely the same thing. "I hope your journey was comfortable," he said. "It was eventful," she said, thinking of the mud. Something moved in his expression, a fractional shift that might, in a less controlled face, have been the beginning of amusement. "Derbyshire roads," he said, by way of explanation or apology. It was unclear which. "Indeed," she said. The conversation that followed was the kind of conversation that happens between two strangers who are being observed by their respective families and who have both, through long training, developed the ability to produce socially appropriate words on any subject, while the actual part of their mind that does real thinking is engaged elsewhere entirely. They discussed the journey. They discussed the weather, which had the considerable virtue of being an inexhaustible subject. They discussed briefly the formal gardens visible through the drawing-room window, about which Mary said something she hoped sounded informed, and the Duke said something that was, she suspected, considerably more informed. Her mother watched all of this with the satisfaction of an audience at a performance going exactly as rehearsed. Her father ate 3 sandwiches. When the visit concluded and her parents were shown to their rooms, a maid appeared to escort Mary to hers. She followed through corridors that continued the drawing-room's theme of careful beauty, art that had been chosen rather than inherited, surfaces that were clean without being sterile, the general atmosphere of a house that was looked after by people who understood the difference between maintenance and care. She was shown into a bedroom that overlooked the formal garden, with a fireplace already lit and a window seat wide enough to sit in comfortably. On the table beside the bed, someone had placed a small vase of late-season flowers. Nothing grand, just a few stems arranged with genuine attention. The maid, a girl of perhaps 17 with a round face and an expression of transparent curiosity, barely contained behind professional neutrality, hesitated at the door. "Is there anything you need, miss?" "Who arranged the flowers?" Mary asked. The maid blinked. "Mrs. Hatch, the housekeeper, miss. She does them herself for guests." "They're lovely," Mary said. "Please tell her so." The maid's expression shifted from professional neutrality to something warmer. "Yes, miss," she said, and left with the air of someone carrying a small, pleasant errand. Mary sat on the window seat and looked at the garden, and thought about the Duke's grey eyes doing their inventory, and about the books with their well-worn spines, and about the flowers that the housekeeper had arranged herself, and tried to construct from these details a picture of what her life was about to become. She could not, yet. There was not enough information. She was, she decided, going to need considerably more information. Part 2. The kitchen question. The information arrived the following morning, with the efficiency of a natural disaster. It began with breakfast. Mary had always considered herself a reasonably capable person. She could read 4 languages, play the pianoforte with genuine skill rather than mere technical competence, manage a household budget with the precision of someone who had learned early that numbers did not forgive inattention, and conduct herself in social situations with the ease of someone who genuinely liked people and was interested in what they thought. She was, her mother had always said, an exceptionally capable young woman. What she was not and had never pretended to be was a cook. This had never previously mattered. In the Whitmore household, cooking was conducted by cook, a woman of 50 whose domain was the kitchen and whose opinion on matters outside the kitchen was not solicited and whose opinion on matters inside it was absolute. Mary had entered the kitchen perhaps 4 times in her life, all of them accidentally. She became aware that this might be a problem when, at breakfast, the Duke asked her, with the careful tone of someone approaching a subject they have thought about in advance, whether she was familiar with the management of a large household. "I am," she said, with complete honesty. "I managed my mother's household accounts from the age of 16. I understand staff management, provisioning, budgeting, the organization of the kitchen," he said. "Specifically," she looked at him. "The kitchen," she repeated. "The management of it," he said. "The oversight of the cook, the planning of menus, the understanding of provisions, ingredients." He paused. "Cooking." There was a silence during which Mary conducted a rapid internal assessment and arrived at the conclusion that the honest answer, while not the answer she would have chosen to give on this particular morning, was the only answer available to her. "I do not cook," she said. The Duke set down his coffee cup with the careful precision of a man receiving information he has suspected but hoped to have disproved. "You do not cook," he said. "I have a thorough understanding of household management in most respects," she said. "I am an excellent administrator. I am competent at budgeting, staff direction, social organization, and the planning of formal events. I am also reliably capable of identifying when food has gone wrong, which I understand is a useful quality in the oversight of a kitchen." She paused. "I cannot, myself, cook." "Can you," he said, with the careful precision of someone working through a list, "distinguish between, for example, thyme and rosemary?" She considered this. "They are both herbs," she said. "Yes," he said. "They are both herbs. One is greener," she offered. The Duke picked up his coffee cup again. He looked at it for a moment with the expression of a man who is revising a set of assumptions that he had considered reasonably well-founded. "Miss Whitmore," he said, "may I ask, what was your understanding of what this marriage would require of you?" She set down her own cup and looked at him directly, because if there was one thing she had decided the previous evening in her window-seat assessment of the available information, it was that this man would respond better to honesty than to performance. "I understood it would require the management of a large estate and household," she said, "the maintenance of appropriate social relations, the organization of a life shared with someone I did not yet know, in circumstances not entirely of my choosing." She paused. "I did not understand that it would require specific expertise in the identification of herbs." Something moved in his gray eyes. Not quite amusement, something more complicated than amusement. The expression of a man who has received an honest answer when he was prepared for an evasive one and is adjusting accordingly. "What was your understanding of what I would be?" he asked. The question was direct, and she understood it as an invitation for the same directness she had just displayed. "Gentlemanly," she said. "Refined. Possessed of the qualities that..." She stopped, because the next words were that the novels promised, and she had sufficient self-awareness to recognize that citing novels as her source material was not going to strengthen her position. "Possessed of the qualities appropriate to his position," she said instead. "And am I?" he said. She looked at him. At the angular face and the grey inventory eyes and the dark hair that was having a marginally better morning than yesterday, but remained distinctly uninterested in social convention. "You are," she said, "more complicated than I expected." He was quiet for a moment. "As are you," he said. The week that followed was an education in the specific ways that two people who have been placed in proximity by external arrangement can manage to misunderstand each other with consistent creativity and impressive efficiency. The first major incident involved the kitchen. Anthony, she had begun in her private thoughts, to call him Anthony rather than the Duke, because the Duke was a title and Anthony was the man she was actually dealing with, and she had always found it useful to be precise, had mentioned, with a careful casualness that she recognized as the tone he used for things he considered important, that the previous cook had left the household 3 weeks, Caxo under circumstances he did not elaborate on, and that the replacement had not yet been secured, and that in the interim the kitchen was being managed by Mrs. Hatch, the housekeeper, who was an excellent housekeeper and a competent but uninspired cook. "I mention this," he said, because the dinner we are hosting for Lord and Lady Ashworth on Friday will require something more than Mrs. Hatch's competence. I see, Mary said. I wondered whether you might... He stopped. Whether I might cook it, she said. Whether you might oversee the arrangements, he said, with the dignity of a man retreating to higher ground. I will oversee the arrangements, she said. I will find a cook. She found one by Wednesday. A woman from the village whose reputation had been recommended by 3 separate people, and who arrived at the kitchen on Thursday morning to inspect the facilities with the focused authority of someone assessing a battlefield before committing their forces. Mary showed her the kitchen, with the confidence of someone who knew where the kitchen was, and the knowledge of someone who had been in it exactly once since her arrival. The cook, Mrs. Birch, a woman of 40 with forearms that suggested a long and productive relationship with bread dough, looked at Mary with the frank assessment of someone who has immediately identified the relevant facts of a situation. You don't cook, Mrs. Birch said. I do not, Mary agreed. I manage. You cook. Together we will produce a dinner that does not embarrass the household. Does that arrangement suit you? Mrs. Birch looked at her for a moment longer. Yes, she said. That arrangement suits me. The dinner on Friday was, by any objective standard, a considerable success. Lord and Lady Ashworth were fed a meal of 4 courses, each executed with the competence that Mrs. Birch brought to everything, and the particular quality of organization that Mary brought to anything she put her mind to. The soup was served at the correct temperature. The fish arrived at the correct moment. The pudding was of a standard that drew a genuine compliment from Lady Ashworth, who had opinions about puddings and expressed them freely. Anthony, seated at the head of his table with an expression of controlled satisfaction, caught Mary's eye at one point during the fish course. She returned the look with the particular composure of someone who has accomplished something and is choosing not to be obvious about it. Afterward, when the guests had gone and the household had settled into its evening quiet, she was in the library, a room she had identified on her second day as the best room in the house, for the same reasons she had identified it in her initial survey. The books were real, the fire was adequate, and no one came to look for her there when Anthony appeared in the doorway. The dinner was well managed, he said. Mrs. Birch is an excellent cook, Mary said without looking up from her book. You found her in 2 days. I asked the right people the right questions, she said. That is management. He came into the library and stood by the fire with the ease of a man in a room he considers his own, which, she reminded herself, it was. You read? He said, looking at the book in her hands. She looked up at him with the expression this question deserved. Extensively, she said. He looked at the book, then at the shelves, then, with a quality of attention that was different from his usual inventory taking at her. What are you reading? He said. She showed him the spine. He was quiet for a moment. That is not what I expected you to be reading, he said. What did you expect me to be reading? Something with more sentiment and less philosophy, he said. I contain multitudes, she said, and returned to her book. He sat down across from her, which she had not expected. She did not look up, because she had learned in her first week that Anthony Ashford was a man who responded to being observed, with a closing off that was not hostility, but was functionally similar, and that the best conversations she had had with him had happened in contexts where neither of them was watching the other too directly. My last cook, he said, after a silence long enough to establish that the silence itself was a choice, left because I told her that the sauce she had been producing for the previous 6 months was not what I had asked for, and that I would like it done correctly. Mary turned a page. What was wrong with the sauce? It was sweet, he said. I had asked for savory. She had apparently decided that sweet was better, and had been substituting her judgment for my instructions for 30 years without informing me. Did you tell her this directly? Mary said. Yes. And she left. Immediately. Mary considered this. That seems an extreme response to a correction. That is what I thought, he said, with the feeling of a man who has been puzzled by something for some time and is relieved to encounter agreement. Perhaps, Mary said carefully, the correction was delivered in a way that felt less like a correction and more like a verdict. The silence that followed this was a different kind of silence from the previous one. I am direct, he said. I consider it a virtue. It is a virtue, she said. It is also a skill, and like all skills, its value depends on the precision of its application. She turned another page. A scalpel is useful. A scalpel applied without consideration of what you are cutting is something else. He looked at her. She continued reading. You are also direct, he said after a moment. Yes, she agreed. I find it more efficient than the alternative. and yet you managed to tell me something critical about my conduct without making me want to leave the room. She looked up at him then, because this was worth looking up for. I told you something observational, she said. There is a difference between an observation and a judgment. An observation offers information. A judgment delivers a verdict, she paused. People can do something with information. There is nothing to do with a verdict except accept or reject it. He looked at her with the grey eyes that she had spent a week learning to read and was still finding new registers in. Where did you learn that? He said. Novels, she said, and had the considerable pleasure of watching his expression attempt to process whether she was serious. She was, as it happened, entirely serious, but she let him wonder. Part 3. Society Ways. In London received news of the Ravenshire engagement with the enthusiasm that London reserved for any development that provided fresh material for discussion. The Duke of Ravenshire was marrying a Whitmore, a family of adequate standing and modest fortune, which prompted the first wave of commentary. Miss Mary Whitmore had been seen twice at Almack's and had attracted no particular notice, which prompted the second. The arrangement had been made quickly and without the usual period of public courtship, which prompted the third. The cumulative effect was that by the time Mary accompanied Anthony to a dinner at the home of Lord and Lady Pembridge, the first formal social outing of their engagement, she had already been thoroughly discussed by people who had not met her, assessed by people who would not have introduced themselves to her 3 months ago, and provided with unsolicited opinions on her situation by 3C. Parade acquaintances of her mother, who had taken it upon themselves to ensure she understood what she was walking into. What she was walking into was a drawing room of 32 people, most of whom turned with the discreet but unmistakable orientation of a well-trained social animal to observe her arrival. Anthony, beside her, appeared entirely unaware of this. She suspected he was entirely aware of it, and had simply decided somewhere in the preceding 32 years to treat the observation of others as a meteorological event, something that happened that had effects, and that could not be meaningfully addressed by acknowledging it. She had decided in the carriage on her own approach. She would be exactly herself, at the precise pitch and volume that the occasion required, and she would not apologize for any of it. The first person who spoke to her was Lady Pembridge herself, a woman of 50 with the particular social authority of someone who has been significant in every room she has entered for 3 decades and has stopped requiring confirmation of this. Miss Whitmore, Lady Pembridge said, with the warmth of someone who has decided provisionally to be generous, we have heard a great deal about you. I hope some of it was accurate, Mary said pleasantly. Lady Pembridge's expression registered this response with the fractional recalibration of someone who expected something more deferential and has received something more interesting. You are not what I expected, Lady Pembridge said. I find that is frequently the case, Mary said. I have stopped taking it as criticism. Lady Pembridge looked at her for a moment. Then she smiled, genuinely, without the social overlay. Come, she said. I will introduce you to people worth knowing. This was, Mary understood, a significant development. Lady Pembridge's patronage was the social equivalent of a letter of introduction signed by the relevant authorities, not sufficient to open every door, but sufficient to ensure that the doors that mattered were not closed. Anthony appeared at her elbow during the pre-dinner gathering, which she noted because she had not seen him approach. Lady Pembridge appears to like you, he said in an undertone. Lady Pembridge is a woman of discernment, Mary said. She is not like the last 4 women I was seen in company with, he said. She told one of them directly that her conversation was decorative but not nourishing. What did the woman say? She agreed, he said, which Lady Pembridge found almost more irritating than the original assessment. Mary looked at him sideways. You find that amusing. I find that honest, he said, which I admit I also find amusing. There is a difference between honesty and unkindness, she said, though they often travel together. Do they travel together when you are honest? He said. She considered this genuinely. I try to ensure they don't, she said. I'm not always successful. No one is, he said. They looked at each other in the way that they had begun over the preceding 10 days to look at each other, with the particular attention of 2 people who have discovered that the person they were assigned to is considerably more complicated than the assignment suggested, and who are not yet sure what to do with this discovery, but are finding it increasingly difficult to ignore. Then Lord Pembridge appeared, and bore Anthony away to discuss something parliamentary, and Mary turned back to the room and went to be interesting to the people Lady Pembridge had identified as worth knowing. The second significant social incident of the evening involved a woman named Mrs. Caroline Hurst, who was 30, beautiful, and possessed of the particular quality of attention that people display when they are monitoring something they consider a threat. Mary became aware of Mrs. Hurst approximately 40 minutes into the dinner, when she noticed the woman's gaze returning to Anthony with the frequency and focus of someone conducting surveillance rather than making casual social observation. She filed this information and continued her conversation with the gentleman to her left, who was a retired naval officer with views on navigation that were genuinely interesting once you got past his preliminary assumption that she would not find them so. After dinner in the drawing room, Mrs. Hurst appeared at her side with the smooth inevitability of someone who has planned an approach. "Miss Whitmore," she said, "I have been so hoping to meet you." "Mrs. Hurst," Mary said, "how kind. Anthony, the Duke, is a great friend of our family," Mrs. Hurst said, with the careful emphasis of someone establishing territory. "We have known each other for many years." "How lovely," Mary said, with the pleasant expression of someone who has identified exactly what is happening and has decided to be gracious about it. "He is," Mrs. Hurst continued, "a man of very particular requirements, very specific in his expectations. I have often thought that the woman who marries him will need to be quite exceptionally..." She paused in the way of someone selecting a word that will do multiple tasks simultaneously. "Capable." "I believe you are right," Mary said. "Fortunately, I am quite exceptionally capable," she smiled, "in most respects. Though I have been reliably informed that my herb identification requires development." Mrs. Hurst blinked. "I beg your pardon," she said. "Thyme and rosemary," Mary said helpfully. "I understand they are both green, but I am told the distinction is significant in culinary contexts. I'm working on it." She tilted her head. "Is that the kind of capability you meant, or were you referring to something else? I want to be sure I'm addressing the correct concern." There was a silence. Mrs. Hurst said, No matter," Mary said, with the warmth of someone concluding a satisfactory conversation. "It was so lovely to meet you. I hope we shall see each other again soon." She moved away with the composure of someone who has done something she is pleased about and is not going to be obvious about being pleased. Anthony appeared beside her approximately 90 seconds later. She did not ask how he had known to appear. She suspected he had been watching. "What did you say to Mrs. Hurst?" he said. "I discussed herbs," Mary said. He was quiet for a moment. "She looks," he said, "as though she has encountered something she did not anticipate." "People frequently look that way after discussing herbs," Mary said. "It is a more complex subject than it appears." He made a sound that was, she had come to recognize, the sound Anthony Ashford produced when he was suppressing something he did not wish to visibly express. She had heard it 3 times now, and had each time felt the unreasonable satisfaction of someone who has produced an unexpected result from an experiment. Part 4. Third source. The real difficulty arrived on a Thursday, in the form of a dinner party for 12 that Anthony had arranged 3 weeks earlier, and that required, by any reasonable assessment, a level of culinary production that significantly exceeded Mrs. Birch's scope. Mary had known about the dinner since her first week. She had been planning it with the systematic attention she brought to organized events, guest list, seating, menu, flowers, timing, since Monday. She had confirmed with Mrs. Birch that the proposed menu was achievable. She had arranged for additional staff. She had overseen the pressing of the tablecloths and the polishing of the silver, and the selection of the wines with an efficiency that had caused Mrs. Hatch, the housekeeper, to observe to one of the maids that the young mistress had a head for organization that she had not observed in any previous visitor to Ravenshire Park. What she had not anticipated was Anthony's involvement in the sauce. She discovered this involvement at 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, when she went to the kitchen to confirm the timing with Mrs. Birch, and found Anthony there instead, standing at the stove with his coat removed and his sleeves rolled to the elbow, engaged in what appeared to be a serious and technical conversation with the sauce. She stopped in the kitchen doorway. He had not heard her. He was tasting something from a wooden spoon, with the focused concentration of someone doing precise analytical work, and then he made an adjustment to something in the pot, with the confidence of someone who has done this before and knows what they are doing. "Mrs. Birch," she observed, was standing to one side with an expression that was not quite amusement and not quite resigned acceptance, but contained elements of both. "Your Grace," Mary said. He turned. The sight of the Duke of Ravenshire in a kitchen with his sleeves rolled up and a wooden spoon in his hand was, she acknowledged privately, not something the novels had prepared her for, and the adjustment it required of her mental picture was not an unpleasant one. "Miss Whitmore," he said, with the composure of a man who has been discovered in an unexpected situation and has decided that the correct response is to behave as if it is entirely unremarkable. "You cook," she said. "I make sauces," he said. "Specifically, my mother's cook taught me when I was 8. I have maintained the skill on the grounds that it is useful and that it gives me something to do when I am thinking." "And are you thinking now?" she said. "I am thinking about the dinner," he said. "Specifically about the sauce, which I have been making for this particular occasion for the past 3 years, and which I did not want to leave to chance." Mary looked at the sauce, then at Anthony, then at Mrs. Birch, whose expression had settled on something closer to amused. "Is it the savory one?" Mary said. "The one your previous cook made sweet?" "Yes," he said. "May I taste it?" she said. He looked at her, the inventory look, the grey-eyed assessment, and then held out the spoon. She tasted it. It was, she acknowledged internally, a very good sauce, complex and savoury, and with a depth of flavour that suggested not just competence, but genuine understanding of what the ingredients were doing and why. "It's excellent," she said. "Thank you," he said, and the way he said it, simply, without deflection or false modesty, told her something she had not previously known about him, that he received a genuine compliment, the same way he delivered a direct observation, without performing anything around it. "You could have told me you cooked," she said. "You could have told me you didn't," he said. They looked at each other in the kitchen, with Mrs. Birch observing from a respectful distance, and the sauce making quiet, productive sounds on the stove. "We have both," Mary said carefully, "been operating on assumptions about each other that were based on incomplete information." "Yes," he said. "I assumed you would be gentlemanly in the specific way that means decorative and manageable and not particularly surprising. And I assumed you would be capable in the specific way that means practical and undemanding and not particularly complicated," he said. "We were both wrong," she said. "Comprehensively," he agreed. "I find," she said, "that I am not disappointed by being wrong." He was quiet for a moment. The sauce continued its productive sounds. "Mrs. Birch appeared to find something requiring her attention at the far end of the kitchen. Nor am I," he said. Part 5. What Anthony knew. The dinner on Thursday was 12 people, 4 courses, 1 excellent sauce, and the most socially successful evening Ravenshire Park had hosted in 3 years, according to Mrs. Hatch, who had been there for all 3 years and had opinions. What made it successful was not primarily the food, though the food was very good. What made it successful was the particular combination of Anthony's precise social knowledge and Mary's genuine interest in people, which turned out to be complementary in ways that neither of them had anticipated and that several of the guests commented on to each other afterward. Anthony knew everyone in the room in the way of someone who has grown up in a world and understands its mechanics, who was connected to whom, which alliances were current and which were historical, which topics were productive and which were landmines, the specific calibration of attention that each guest required to feel appropriately seen. He deployed this knowledge with efficiency and without sentiment, a well-oiled social machine. Mary was interested in everyone in the room in the way of someone who finds people genuinely interesting and expresses this with a warmth and specificity that made each person she spoke to feel that their particular conversation was the one she had been looking forward to. She asked questions she actually wanted answers to, which was rarer than it should have been in a London drawing room, and she listened to the answers with an attention that people responded to without quite knowing why. Together, the effect was notable. Sir Edmund Hartley, who had been placed beside Mary at dinner, and who had arrived with the resigned expectation of a man who has been seated beside too many decorative dinner companions, left the table 2 hours later, having discussed his work in natural philosophy with a depth and enthusiasm he had not expected to achieve at a social dinner, and told his wife in the carriage home that Miss Whitmore was one of the most genuinely intelligent women he had encountered outside his laboratory. Lady Constance Webb, who had known Anthony for 15 years and had privately concluded that he would never marry anyone interesting, spent 45 minutes observing the dynamic between Anthony and his fiancée across the dinner table and revised this conclusion with the brisk efficiency she brought to all reassessments. Anthony, at the head of his table, caught Mary's eye 3 times during the dinner. The first time she was managing a conversation between two guests whose opinions on a subject were about to collide unproductively, and the look she gave him was a brief, functional communication. "I need you on the other side of this for approximately 90 seconds. He moved. The collision was averted. The second time, she had said something to the retired admiral on her left that produced a genuine laugh, and the look he caught was the unguarded expression of someone who has achieved exactly what they were trying to achieve and allowed themselves a private moment of satisfaction. The third time she caught him watching her, and the look she gave him then was different from the first two, direct, unguarded, a question she was not yet ready to ask aloud. He did not look away. She did not look away. Lord Pembridge, who had been watching the Duke of Ravenshire with the attention of a man who has known him for 20 years and is observing something he has not previously seen, said to his wife later that evening, "I think Ravenshire may actually be happy." Lady Pembridge, who had formed her own conclusions somewhat earlier, said, "He is not happy yet, but I think he is beginning to understand that he could be." After the guests had gone, Mary was in the library, her library, she had come to think of it, though it was technically his, with a cup of tea that had gone cold because she had been thinking rather than drinking. The fire had burned down to comfortable coals. Outside, the November night was doing what November nights in Derbyshire do, which is to say everything it could to make the indoors feel like the only reasonable option. Anthony came in. He did not announce himself, and she did not look up, both of which had become their established pattern in this room, a room where the rules were slightly different from the rest of the house. He sat across from her. He did not have a book. "The dinner was a success," he said. "Yes," she agreed. "Mrs. Birch did excellent work." "The sauce," he said, "was not Mrs. Birch." "No," she said. "The sauce was you." She looked up. "You should have told people that." "Dukes do not generally announce their culinary contributions to their own dinner parties," he said. "Why not?" He considered this with the honest attention he gave to things that required it. "Convention," he said. "Convention," she repeated, with the tone of someone who has heard this word used as an explanation too many times and has stopped accepting it as one. "You have very little patience for convention," he observed. "I have appropriate patience for conventions that serve a useful purpose," she said. "I have no patience for conventions that exist primarily to prevent people from being themselves." She paused. "You make an excellent sauce. That is a real and specific thing about you. Convention requires that you conceal it, because it is not what dukes do. I find that a poor trade." He was quiet for a long moment. "My father," he said, "was a man who considered the performance of the dukedom the primary requirement of the role. Everything else, personal preferences, genuine capabilities, things he actually wanted, was secondary to the performance." He looked at the coals. "I've spent 32 years trying to determine whether I agree with him." "Do you?" she said. "Less and less," he said, which was not quite an answer and was also, she understood, the most honest thing he had said to her since the conversation about the sauce. "The herbs," she said, "thyme and rosemary, will you show me the difference?" He looked at her, the grey eyes doing their assessment, arriving somewhere. "Now?" he said. "There is no better time," she said. He stood. She stood. They went to the kitchen, where the remnants of the dinner were being managed by the staff with the efficient quiet of professionals at the end of a successful evening, and Anthony showed her thyme and rosemary by the light of the kitchen lamp, holding each in turn and explaining, not with condescension but with the genuine enthusiasm of someone for whom this knowledge was real and specific and worth sharing, the difference in appearance, in texture, in smell, in what each did in a sauce and why. She paid attention. She asked questions, real ones, because the subject was, she discovered, genuinely interesting once someone explained why it mattered. She learned the difference between thyme and rosemary in a kitchen in Derbyshire at 11 o'clock on a November night, and later, when she tried to identify the precise moment at which something shifted between them, she would return to this. Anthony's hands holding the herbs in the lamplight, her genuine attention, the kitchen quiet around them, and the particular quality of ease that comes when two people stop performing for each other and are simply, entirely, present in the same moment. Part 6. December. December brought frost to the Derbyshire grounds, and a succession of social obligations that required their combined navigation, a task they had, by this point, developed a functional partnership, for that neither of them had planned, and both of them had come to rely on. There was the Ashworth's dinner, at which Mary managed a difficult conversation between two guests whose mutual history was more complicated than the seating plan had accounted for, and Anthony appeared at precisely the moment when a redirection was required, with the word required to redirect it. There was the Pembridge Ball at which they danced twice, the required once and then because the music was good, and neither of them proposed stopping, a second time, and at which Lady Pembridge observed to her husband that whatever she had expected of this match, it was not this, and that she found she was glad to have been wrong. There was also the incident with the correspondence. Mary had been managing the household correspondence since her third week, a task Anthony had delegated with the evident relief of someone releasing a responsibility they had been discharging inadequately. She was good at it. She was, if she was honest, extremely good at it, in the specific way of someone who finds the organization of complex information satisfying rather than tedious, and who brings to written communication the same attention she brought to conversation. She was working through the week's letters on a Wednesday morning when she came across one that was not household correspondence. It was addressed to Anthony, from a firm of solicitors in London, regarding what appeared to be a financial matter of some complexity, specifically a debt that had been accumulating for several years against a property in the north of the estate, which the letter described as approaching a point of required decision. She set the letter aside without reading further, because it was not addressed to her and its contents were not her business. She placed it on top of the stack for Anthony's attention, with a note indicating it appeared to require a response. He came to find her that afternoon. "The letter from Hartley and Sons," he said. "I set it aside," she said. "It appeared to require your personal attention." He sat down across from her at the correspondence desk, a thing he had not previously done, the correspondence desk being, in the established geography of their respective territories, her space, and looked at the letter. "The Northern property," he said. "I have been managing a situation with it for 3 years that has not resolved itself as I hoped. You do not need to explain it to me," she said. "I know I do not need to," he said. "I am choosing to." He looked at her. "You manage this household with a precision I have not previously experienced. I would value your assessment." She looked at him for a moment, the careful look she gave things she was deciding whether to engage with fully. "Show me the relevant documents," she said. He showed her. She read them with the focused attention she gave to financial matters, asking 3 questions and receiving 3 direct answers, and then she set the papers down and told him what she saw, the nature of the problem, the options as she understood them, the considerations she would weigh in making the decision. She was clear and specific, and did not soften the parts that were difficult. When she finished, Anthony was quiet for a long moment. "That is," he said, "almost precisely the assessment my solicitor gave me last month, with one addition." "Which addition?" she said. He did not observe that the third option, the one that appears least attractive from a short-term financial perspective, is the only one consistent with maintaining the tenants currently working the land. He paused. "You observed it. The tenants are a real consideration," she said. 12 families by the records I have seen. Decisions about property have consequences for people who are not party to the decision. That seemed worth noting. He looked at her with the grey eyes that she had spent 2 months learning and was still finding new things in. "Yes," he said. "It did." It was the second week of December when Anthony told her in the library on a Tuesday evening, with a fire that had been properly maintained and tea that was still warm, that he had been wrong about what he was looking for. He said it the way he said most important things, directly, without preparation, with the quality of a man who has thought about something until he was sure of it, and then said it. "I told myself I wanted someone capable," he said, "practical, able to manage the household and the social requirements and the practical dimensions of this life without requiring," he paused, "without requiring me to be other than I am." "And?" she said. "And I was right about what I wanted," he said. "I was wrong about what capable meant. I thought it meant efficient. I thought it meant manageable." He looked at her. "It means what you are, which is considerably more than I was prepared for." Mary set down her teacup. "I told myself I wanted someone gentlemanly," she said. "Refined. Someone who would be..." She stopped because the honest version of this was slightly embarrassing. "I had constructed a picture," she said, "from novels and imagination and the particular optimism of someone who has not yet had their optimism tested. The picture was of someone charming and gracious and uncomplicated." "And," he said, "and you are none of those things," she said. "You are direct and complicated, and entirely yourself in a way that most people I have met are not, and I have found, to my considerable surprise, that this is more interesting than the picture I had." He was quiet. "I make a good source," he said. "You make an excellent source," she said, "and you know the difference between thyme and rosemary. And you understand which option protects 12 tenant families, even when it is not the financially convenient one. And you moved across a dinner table in exactly the right moment 3 Thursdays ago without being asked. She held his gaze. You are not what I expected. I find I am grateful for that. The fire did what fires do on December evenings in Derbyshire, which is to say it was warm and adequate, and entirely appropriate for the occasion. Mary, he said, her name without the title for the first time, and the difference was not small. Anthony, she said, I would like this to be a real marriage, he said, not an arrangement that we manage with competence and mutual respect. A real one, he paused. I find I am not interested in competence and mutual respect alone. What are you interested in? She said. This, he said. What is actually happening, whatever this is. She looked at him for a long moment, the full assessment, the grey eyes and the angular face, and the man who made sauce at 11 o'clock on a November night and had 12 tenant families in his third option. I think, she said, that what this is the beginning of something considerably better than either of us planned. Yes, he said, I believe it is. Part 7. The Wedding and After. They were married in January in the church nearest Ravenshire Park, in the presence of both their families and a selection of Derbyshire society that had been following the engagement with the interest of people with insufficient other entertainment. Mary wore ivory. The flowers were arranged by Mrs. Hatch, who had been arranging flowers in this household for 20 years, and who produced for the occasion something that several guests described as the finest floral work they had seen in a church in Derbyshire, which was saying something. Anthony stood at the altar with the expression of a man who has made a decision he is entirely at peace with, not the performed contentment of social obligation, but the specific settled quality of genuine choice. When Mary came through the church doors on her father's arm, Anthony watched her approach with the grey inventory eyes, doing their assessment, and she watched him watch her, and understood what the inventory was finding. She smiled, not the composed, appropriate smile she had trained for occasions of significance, but the real one, the one that she had deployed perhaps twice in his presence previously, and that he had, both times, responded to by being visibly affected in ways he had not fully succeeded in concealing. He was visibly affected now. He did not conceal it at all. Her father, delivering her to the altar with the satisfaction of a man who had been anxious about this outcome, and has been relieved of his anxiety, shook Anthony's hand and said something quietly that she did not hear. Later, she asked Anthony what he had said. He said, "She is considerably more than she appears, and I hope you already know that." "And what did you say?" she said. "I said, yes," Anthony said, "I know." The marriage, as marriages do, developed its own specific texture in the months that followed. There were things she had not expected, and which turned out to be, consistently, among the best things. The discovery that Anthony read with the same seriousness and appetite she did, and that his taste ran in directions that intersected with hers at enough points to make the shared library genuinely shared rather than merely divided. The discovery that he had opinions about gardens that were specific and considered, and that produced, when she offered a contrary view, a conversation rather than a concession. The discovery that he laughed, fully, without performance, at things she said, and that his laughter was one of the sounds she had not known she was looking for, but now could not imagine the absence of. There were also the kitchen Tuesdays. These had begun as a practical arrangement. She had proposed in her second month of the marriage that it might be useful for her to understand not just the management of the kitchen, but the actual production of food in it, on the grounds that effective oversight required genuine comprehension of what was being overseen. Anthony had offered to begin the education. Mrs. Birch had been informed and had arranged her own Tuesday activities around the alcove at the far end of the kitchen, where she could, she explained, work on the week's preserves. What the Kitchen Tuesdays had become over 5 months was the hour of the week that both of them protected most carefully from the encroachments of the social calendar. Anthony taught her to make the sauce. This took 3 Tuesdays. The first Tuesday produced something that was, by any honest assessment, not the sauce. It was a reasonable liquid with some of the correct characteristics and none of the correct depth, and Anthony tasted it with the focused analytical expression he brought to all things requiring assessment, and said simply, "Not yet." The second Tuesday produced something closer, and the assessment was better. The timing is the issue. The third Tuesday produced something that she tasted and understood in the direct physical way that genuine success makes itself known was right. Anthony tasted it and said nothing for a moment, then, "That is the sauce. Yes, she said. How did you know when the timing was correct? He said. I stopped thinking about the timing, she said, and started thinking about what I was making and why. He looked at her. That is, he said, the most important thing about cooking. I suspect it is the most important thing about most things, she said. Mrs. Birch, in her alcove, was entirely focused on the preserves and noticed nothing. Epilogue. The inventory. 2 years into the marriage, on a January evening that bore a considerable resemblance in its weather to the January evening on which they had been married, Anthony came into the library to find Mary asleep in the chair that had been her chair since her first week at Ravenshire Park, a book open in her lap, the fire adequately maintained. He stood in the doorway for a moment and conducted the inventory, the habit he had carried for 32 years that had begun as a survival mechanism in a world that rewarded accurate assessment and had gradually, over the past 2 years, shifted its primary function. He was not checking for problems. He was looking at his wife. He noted the book, which was the third volume of a series she had been reading for a week and had been talking about at dinner with the specific enthusiasm of someone who wants to discuss what they are reading and has identified in their dinner companion a person worth discussing it with. The fire, which she had built up before she fell asleep, because she had been in the room for 3 hours and had learned in 2 years the particular behavior of this fireplace in January. Her hands, which were folded in her lap over the book, with the relaxed completeness of someone entirely at ease in a space that has become genuinely their own. The assessment concluded, as it had concluded for 2 years now with the same finding, that the inventory of his life, conducted honestly and with attention to what was actually present, rather than what was supposed to be there, produced results that no one, least of all himself, would have predicted from a carriage ride through Derbyshire mud and a breakfast conversation about herbs. He crossed the room and added a log to the fire, quietly because she was asleep and sleep was not to be disturbed without reason, and then sat in the chair across from her, which was his chair, which had been his chair from the beginning, because the library had been his room and then had become their room, and the distinction was one of the more significant things that had happened in his life. He picked up his book. She woke up approximately 20 minutes later, gradually in the way of someone returning from a pleasant distance, and looked at him across the firelit room with the expression she reserved for moments when she was not yet fully performing anything. You came home early, she said. The Pembridge reception was concluded, he said. I found I preferred to be here. She looked at him for a moment with the amber eyes that he had spent 2 years learning and was still finding new things in. Was Mrs. Hurst there? She said. She was, he said. Did she discuss anything interesting? She attempted to discuss several things, he said. I was preoccupied. With what? With the thought, he said, that the sauce needs adjusting for the dinner next week, and that I should consult with you about it before Thursday, because your instinct for timing has, in the past 6 months, become more reliable than mine. She looked at him steadily. That is not what you were thinking about, she said. No, he agreed. It is not. What were you thinking about? He closed his book. He looked at her across the fire with the grey eyes that had been conducting inventories since before she arrived, and that had, 2 years ago, arrived at an assessment that had continued to be confirmed by every piece of evidence that had accumulated since. I was thinking, he said, that I came to this marriage looking for someone capable and found someone extraordinary, and that the difference between those two things is the most significant discovery I have made in 34 years. The fire did what fires do. The clock on the mantelpiece, the one that had been keeping accurate time since before anyone currently present was born, continued its steady work. Mary closed her book. I came to this marriage, she said, looking for a gentleman. I found someone who makes excellent sauce, teaches herbs by lamplight at 11 o'clock at night, protects 12 tenant families in the third option, and reads with the same seriousness I do. She paused. I find that to be a considerably better outcome than the one I was looking for. Yes, he said. So do I. Outside, the January night continued its Derbyshire work. Inside, the fire was warm, the books were real, and the library that had once been one person's room and had become two people's room continued to be exactly what it had always been, the best room in the house, which was the point of everything. On the kitchen shelf between the rosemary and the thyme sat a small card in Mary's handwriting that had been there since March, and that Mrs. Birch had decided, without consulting anyone, to leave exactly where it was. It said, they are both green. The rosemary is the one that smells like a forest, and the thyme is the one that smells like honesty. Do not confuse them. Mrs. Birch had read it once, on the day it appeared, and had decided it was the most accurate thing she had seen written in a kitchen in 30 years of cooking. She was not wrong. She had come looking for a gentleman and found a man. He had come looking for capability and found a person. The difference in both cases was everything. And somewhere between a breakfast conversation about herbs and a November kitchen and a third option that protected 12 families and a library that became theirs instead of his, they had both found what they were actually looking for, which was, as it tends to be, nothing like what they had planned and exactly what they needed. If this story made you smile, share it with someone who needs one today. Tell us, have you ever found something completely different from what you were looking for and discovered it was better? Subscribe for more stories of love, laughter, and the quiet surprise of finding exactly the right person in exactly the wrong expectations.